Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 23, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Yates Memo. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we have Chairman of the Executive Committee of our Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, John Malcolm, here to moderate, so I will turn things over to him for introductions. John, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Will, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this today. On September the 9th of this year, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates issued a guidance memorandum to all federal, criminal, and civil assistant U.S. attorneys on the subject of individual accountability for corporate wrongdoing. This is only the latest in a series of memoranda that have been issued by deputy AGs on this subject, clarifying, expanding upon, and at times contracting the broad principles that were laid down in the so-called Thompson Memo for Larry Thompson, issued in 2003, in which he stated, and I quote, "Too often business organizations, while purporting to cooperate with the department investigation, in fact take steps to impede the quick and effective exposure of the complete scope of wrongdoing under investigation." In the latest memo, Ms. Yates stated that, quote, "fighting corporate fraud and other misconduct is a top priority of the Department of Justice," but she acknowledged that there are many substantial challenges unique to pursuing individuals for corporate misdeeds. The memo goes on to state, among other things, that absent extraordinary circumstances, the department will not release culpable individuals from civil or criminal liability when resolving a matter with a corporation, and also states, most significantly, that, quote, "In order for a company to receive any consideration for cooperation under the principles of federal prosecution of business organizations, the company must completely disclose to the department all relevant facts about individual misconduct. Companies cannot pick and choose what fact to disclose. That is, to be eligible for any credit for cooperation, the company must identify all individuals involved in or responsible for the misconduct at issue, regardless of their position, status, or seniority, and provide to the department all facts relating to that misconduct. If a company seeking cooperation credit declines to learn of such facts or to provide the department with complete factual information about individual wrongdoers, its cooperation will not be considered a mitigating factor." We have with us today two outstanding speakers to tell us what this all means and whether this is a positive or negative development. Speaking first will be Jim Copeland. Jim is the director and a senior legal fellow at the Manhattan Institute's Center for Legal Policy, which seeks to develop and communicate novel, sound ideas on how to improve America's civil and criminal justice systems. Jim received his undergraduate degree from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, has a Master's of Science degree from the London School of Economics, and both a JD and an MBA from Yale. After graduating law school, Jim clerked for the Honorable Ralph Winters on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and also served as a management consultant with McKinsey & Company before joining the Manhattan Institute. Jim has testified before Congress on several occasions. His articles have appeared in scholarly journals and newspapers throughout the country, and he is a frequent commentator on radio and television. After Jim, we will hear from Paul Larkin. Paul works with me at the Mies Center at the Heritage Foundation as a senior legal fellow, and he directs our overcriminalization project. Paul got his undergraduate degree from Washington and Lee, a master's degree from George Washington University, and his law degree from Stanford. After graduating from law school, Paul clerked for the Honorable Robert Bork on the D.C. Circuit. Paul has held a number of interesting positions in both public and private sector, including working for the Senate Judiciary Committee. He served as a federal agent at the Environmental Protection Agency, and he worked in the Organized Crime and Racketeering Section at the Department of Justice and also served as an Assistant Solicitor General, where he argued 27 cases before the Supreme Court. And with that, Jim, let me turn it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, John, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having us. I'm going to just start off with some of the broader context here. As John alluded to, the Yates memo that we're here talking about specifically today is the latest in a series of memoranda on how the Justice Department deals with investigations of corporations for alleged criminality. And this is really something that dates back a little over 20 years now, in the early 90s when Congress charged the Sentencing Commission with developing guidelines for organizations. They did so, and in May of 1992, the first federal non-prosecution agreement was entered into between the first Bush Justice Department and Solomon Brothers. And since that time, we've seen an explosion of this sort of behavior on the part of the Justice Department and vis-a-vis corporations, which I have called critically the shadow regulatory state. It's sort of the area of regulation people don't know about. I wouldn't go as far as The Economist in comparing this to the Sicilian Mafia or the Kremlin or things like that, but it is a sweeping form of corporate regulation. So the first 41 U.S. presidents had one of these deferred or non-prosecution agreements negotiated with businesses. Under the Clinton administration, there were 11. Under the second Bush administration, George W. Bush, there were 130. And as of last winter, there had been 190 such agreements reached during the first parts here of the Obama administration. So you can clearly see the growth of this type of negotiation between business and the Department of Justice. And as of last winter, 16 of the largest 100 U.S. businesses by revenues had been under federal supervision through a deferred or non-prosecution agreement in the prior 5 years, as well as 13 other of the largest 300 companies around the world. So the impact of these agreements is quite large. What jump-started these was really the collapse of Arthur Andersen. So as John alluded to, the Thompson memo, the first actual memo in this series was issued in 1999 under then Deputy Attorney General Holder, our immediate past U.S. Attorney General. But then after Arthur Andersen, people at the Justice Department got spooked, more or less, because the accounting company, one of the five largest accountancies in the United States, went under after it was indicted in the fallout from the Enron scandal. And so Larry Thompson issued a memorandum basically saying corporations have to cooperate, and here's what that means. And if you do that, we won't actually take you to trial. And that really jump-started this deferred and non-prosecution agreement regulatory structure. A lot of people were quite concerned after the initial Thompson memorandum in that the memorandum basically said that would include waivers of attorney-client privilege and work product privilege, various sorts of protections for employees. And a series of follow-up memoranda by later Deputy Attorneys General clarified this and effectively backed away from that and reestablished attorney-client privilege as an important thing to protect. The McNulty memo came out in 2006. The Phillip memo came out in 2008, and those memoranda were eventually codified in the U.S. Attorney's Manual under the principles of federal prosecution of business organizations. So that's really where we were when the Yates memo came out. Clearly, there's been a lot of sort of political discussion, political pressure placed on the Department of Justice that since the financial crisis in 2008, there have really been very few individual prosecutions, and there have been these mammoth multi-billion-dollar negotiated settlements, civil and criminal, with companies, but not a lot of individual prosecutions. So when I first heard about the Yates memo coming out, I said, oh, that's good that they're actually going to target more on individuals. In my paper last winter, the most recent paper we'd written on deferred and non-prosecution agreements, I observed that the process is ill-suited for application to individuals, and that one concern about the increased use of DPAs and NPAs by the federal government is that they give prosecutors broad powers over businesses, notwithstanding that no individual is ever prosecuted for the underlying offense alleged in the agreement. And so at first I said, well, this actually makes sense. It really are individuals, criminal law is really geared toward punishing individuals. individuals. There's not a clear logical distinction between civil and criminal when it comes to businesses, and businesses clearly lack mens rea and some of the sort of traditional metrics for criminal law, though those have also been eroded quite clearly in the federal system. So I thought, this actually could be a good thing. When I actually started reading the substance of the Yates memo, unfortunately, I think there's not a lot of change here, and to the extent there is a change, I view it as basically backtracking somewhat on the work that's been done subsequent to the Thompson Memorandum in terms of protecting work product privilege and attorney-client privilege. Now, there is a sort of throwaway line in the memorandum respecting all privileges, but the basic premise here is that to get agreement to go into a deferred prosecution agreement or even a civil agreement with the Department of Justice on these investigations, they're going to have to turn over lots and lots of documents on individuals. So effectively, they're pitting the corporation against the management or in some cases lower-level individuals who may be implicated in these types of investigations. And that strikes me as particularly troubling, as well as just the notion that I think there may be some effort to try to get individuals on the hook without regard to what the offense may be, looking at it holistically with prosecutorial discretion. So just to explain to the audience sort of the key steps that the memo outlines as significant and or new. First, as I suggested, the cooperation credit under the sentencing guidelines is only permitted for corporations. They're only eligible for this credit if they give the Department of Justice quote, all relevant facts, unquote, which relate to the individuals that are responsible for alleged misconduct, and that's regardless of the level of seniority of the individual. So the first and foremost most significant change is that. The second sort of key step that the memo outlines is that both civil and criminal Department of Justice investigations should focus on individual investigations from the inception of the investigation. This could be a good thing, except for the fact that it doesn't seem like it's a necessary precondition in any way for an ultimate corporate agreement, which is something I've argued should be the case when we're talking about these deferred and non-prosecution agreements. If you can't build a case against an individual, you shouldn't assume broad regulatory powers which exceed the scope of the criminal law in overseeing corporations and changing their conduct. So the third real key step in the memo is basically saying that the attorneys in the Justice Department, both civil or criminal, should be routinely communicating with each other. And so this is really an intra-department rule, basically saying that the communication is going to be with each other, and the criminal attorneys are going to tell the civil attorneys as early as possible when there may be civil liability discovered and vice versa. The fourth step articulated in the memo is that the DOJ should not agree to any corporate resolution that gives immunity to the potential liability or culpability of individuals absent extraordinary circumstances. Now this may or may not be objectionable here. It does mitigate against sort of one of the critiques I'd have of this process, that there may be agency cost concerns here. In other words, you may have individuals that are in management or board positions in companies that are acting adverse to the interests of their own shareholders by cutting deals with the government that the company shouldn't enter into, but they're doing so to protect themselves. So this sort of prevents that, but what it also does is create some pretty extraordinary pressure on the business to basically sell out their employees in these sorts of situations. So the fifth key step in the memo is that the Department of Justice should have a clear plan, quote unquote, whatever that means, to resolve any open investigations of individuals when there's a corporate case. So I mean, I think that makes sense. The problem here again is that these individual prosecutions are going to tend to follow the corporate agreements, and the corporation doesn't have any recourse if the individual is ultimately exonerated in in court. And we've seen these sorts of situations where we've had multi-billion dollar agreements between the government and corporations, and then the individual prosecutions, the individual is actually acquitted, is not convicted of the alleged crime. That doesn't mean that the corporation isn't accountable in some context, but it certainly is disturbing to me the way that tends to happen. And then the sixth step in the memo is that the civil attorneys at the Department of Justice should also be focusing on these individuals and trying to create accountability and deterrent structure. So the basic premise here is to ramp up pressure on the Department of Justice to go after individuals, not just the companies, which is probably in response to some of the public criticism here. I think conceptually there's merit to that idea, but there's nothing in here that I see that really remedies the problems with the deferred non-prosecution agreement process and the shadow regulatory state. There's still no definition of the terms in those agreements. There's still no principles for oversight. There's still no real question about how this is going to intersect or not with various corporate compliance programs. There's no reining in of what the Justice Department's doing. Basically, this is saying we want to come after individuals too. So other than mitigating that agency concern, that agency cost concern, where you may have individuals in management positions that are to cover themselves agreeing to things they shouldn't, I don't think there's a lot to really like about this memorandum. And by and large, though, I mean, I don't want to suggest that this is the end of the world. I think it's effectively doubling down on existing practice, and it's just basically saying we want to make sure you know to come after individuals too. What's troubling to me about all this, of course, is that there are many instances that we see where corporations are agreeing to these agreements and effectively modifying their behavior at the request of Department of Justice officials who don't necessarily understand their business models at all. And they're doing that when there's not a clear legal case, when in some instances it looks to us like it fits in with clearly within a statutory safe harbor. So maybe if there are individual prosecutions here, that'll shed some light on this, but it doesn't seem to me to fix the primary problem we've been worried about. If anything, it's just sort of a doubling down and saying, well, we're going to apply the pressure here to get your managers or lower level employees as well.
Paul, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you to the Federalist Society, and thank you, Jim. I think that was a terrific way of laying out the whole set and the whole scene of what we have here. Let me say, I think when you look at the memo here, the Yates memo, it's important not just to read the lyrics, but to listen to the music. I think there are three very important features to this memo. The first one, Jim identified as well as John early on, it marks in part a major transition from the Thompson memo. The Thompson memo said that a corporation cannot avoid prosecution merely by giving up directors, officers, employees, and agents. The Yates memo changed that. It now says that a corporation cannot receive any credit for cooperation unless it gives up those four types of parties. The result is that diming out directors and officers went from being insufficient by itself to avoid prosecution to being indispensable to avoiding prosecution. That's important because of the second factor. The Yates memo carries forward the multi-factor balancing test set forth in the Thompson memo. Now, laws and policies that have multi-factor balancing tests are a testament to the triumph of equity over law and to the ingenuity of lawyers. The best example I can think of is one adopted once by Justice Blackmun. He adopted a 21-factor test to decide the proper exercise of military court-martial jurisdiction, which gave every appearance of being objective in nature, but to lawyers who practice in this area or others know that a 21-factor test is no test at all. It gives the appearance of being objective, but in fact it is entirely subjective. You have the problem here. I haven't counted up all the different factors, but there are certainly enough of them so that the Justice Department is left with enormous discretion to decide how and whether to go forward. So what we really need to know is how the balancing test will be applied and what problem the memo was designed to resolve. The combination of those factors and the third feature of the Yates memo will really give us a better idea of how this is going to work out. As far as application goes, the Department of Justice has far greater control over the work of the criminal division as well as its branches than over the decision of the U.S. Attorney's offices. U.S. attorneys are also political appointees, and they have their own rabbis in the Senate or the House. When I was at the Justice Department, it was well known that different U.S. attorneys' offices pushed the edge of the envelope and how far they could divert from policies that main justice might have been willing to pursue. And you're going to have the same problem here. So you're not eliminating that necessarily with any type of memorandum, with any type of policy, because ultimately the only real remedy if the department disagrees with a particular U.S. attorney's office is for the attorney general to step in or the deputy attorney general to step in and take over the case. Keep in mind that last term, the Justice Department in the Supreme Court in the Yates case, a case involving a party named Yates rather than the memo here, was willing to argue that the federal criminal laws should make it a crime to engage in a sort of unusual catch-and-release program because anything could be treated as a tangible object. So if you have rather extreme applications of the law, the department isn't necessarily going to come in and second-guess what's happening. So you really are giving U.S. attorneys a great deal of discretion. That's important for this reason. I think a major shift that the Yates memo makes in the earlier memos is that it shifts the burden of the investigation to private parties, to corporations. That comes clearly not just in the memo, but even more importantly in the speech that Deputy Attorney General Yates gave at New York University Law School when she announced the new policy. After a portion of her speech where she talked about the matters that John mentioned at the outset, that a corporation will not receive any credit unless it identifies the individuals involved, she went on to say this, quote, "And we're not going to let corporations plead ignorance. If they don't know who is responsible, they will need to find out. If they want cooperation credit, they will need to investigate and identify the responsible parties, then provide all non-privileged evidence implicating those individuals," unquote. Put aside the non-privileged part of that. What essentially they're saying is a corporation is responsible now for doing the investigation that historically had been done either by the FBI or by the SEC. And unless you can prove to the government's satisfaction that you can establish that particular individuals not only were responsible but can do so in a way that allows the Justice Department to take what you've given them and then go into court to prove the case, you may not get any credit. Now, the attorney-client privilege may be a problem in some cases, and DOJ quite clearly does not want to take that issue on directly. The problem is the Justice Department tried to deal with that issue in the early memos, as Jim pointed out. It caused quite a furor in the legal community and generated substantial opposition from the ABA. The Philip memo walked back from some of the earlier memos in this regard, and the Yates memo does not literally undo what the Philip memo said. Yet fundamentally, it may have that effect. If a corporation cannot disclose admissible evidence that proves the government's case for the government, the corporation may not receive any cooperation credit at all. Now, that could mean that corporations must require all directors, officers, employees, and agents to waive any attorney-client privilege as a condition of doing business with the company. And in fact, it may even require that they raise other types of privileges, because there is always a potential Fifth Amendment self-incrimination privilege that's at issue here. Now, the privilege only applies when the government seeks to investigate information, but if we now have a situation where the government is using the corporation as the cat's paw of the investigative agency, what in essence is going to happen is that private parties will refuse to discuss these matters with the corporation's internal working group, with its lawyers, or with senior officers. Now, granted, they may be fired for that sort of conduct, and it may be they're at risk because there is independent evidence that's going to prove that they're guilty. But I think what it also means is you're going to provide a tremendous disincentive to a lot of these people to come forward with this information because they know the corporation is going to be collecting it and turning it over to the federal government. Now, the Justice Department could address the problem of an insufficient number of individuals being prosecuted for these cases. That's what the Yates memo and speech says the real concern here is. They're not being able to prosecute enough individuals. There are ways to do that, but they cost money. The Justice Department could go to Congress and ask for more FBI special agents or more SEC investigators. Of course, that would mean either increasing taxes or taking money away from parties who are already recipients of different payments by the government, and they are afraid to ask Congress to do that, in part because perhaps Congress won't do it. Another way they could deal with this problem is to go to Congress and ask them to modify the scope of the attorney-client privilege. After all, in the Upjohn case, DOJ argued that the privilege should be limited in the corporation context to a control group. The Supreme Court rejected that argument. The ABA certainly would oppose any opposition. The Justice Department does not want to take on the ABA again. But going to Congress and asking them to narrow the scope of the privilege that a corporation has is another option in this regard. But if you don't do that and you don't ask for more agents, the only option left is the one they seem to have pursued here, which is to put the burden on private parties that normally we expect the government to bear. Normally, we don't expect private parties to take on the burden of investigation. We expect that the police do that. We expect the FBI or the SEC in this context to do that rather than private parties. And that's really quite a change. Now, if you add together the following sort of propositions, you can see that we have resulted in a material change in the way the law was. Add together, one, the fact that corporations can be held criminally liable. Two, that directors and officers can be held criminally liable under the respondeat superior doctrine. Three, that corporations, even though they work as individuals, can be deemed to have all of the knowledge that every particular individual has, the so-called corporate knowledge doctrine. And finally, now four, the Yates memo, which puts the burden of investigation on the corporation itself. What it winds up saying is that corporations, officers, and directors can be presumptively liable for any crime committed by an employee or agent unless one of those parties can prove that someone else is guilty and can give the government proof that it can then use in court. Now, who is the winner of all this? Well, lawyers will be the winners. A lot of directors and officers will demand that they have lawyers and the company pay for it. So clearly it'll be more business for lawyers. The second group that wins are parties who like to see corporations twist in the wind. This will cause problems for corporations because it'll pit some directors against each other, some officers against each other, et cetera. And if you believe that corporations are responsible for more evil in the economy than good, this is to them a positive development. Finally, it allows people who want to just demagogue the issue to say that this is fine. These, like I say, these corporations are more responsible for evil than good. And it makes it extraordinarily difficult for someone to walk away from what's in the Yates memo because the argument will be you're trying to let people off the hook for a responsibility as a corporate officer in a corporation. What's not clear is that the public will benefit because there actually will be an increase in the number of convictions of individuals. The two best arguments for holding corporations liable are that, one, if they're liable, it is easier to remedy the problem because the corporation itself, through its directors and officers, can rearrange whatever situation that the corporation is necessary in order to prevent this wrongdoing from occurring again, such as firing the people involved. And secondly, it does allow the public to feel that corporations are being held responsible for a lot of the evil they cause, even though it's not literally the corporation that does that, it's the individuals. Like Jim, I think prosecuting individuals rather than the corporation is the best way of dealing with this problem. And I agree that there are serious problems in trying to do it. The Deputy Attorney General mentioned the millions of documents that people have to go through, and the number of documents is probably eclipsed by the number of emails we now see. But the best way to deal with that is actually get more investigators involved in the process. Have more FBI agents. Have more SEC investigators. The problem is, as I said, that costs money. If what we see at the end of the day from this memo, and it's at the end of the day, not tomorrow or the day after, where we'll see whether this approach works, but if at the end of the day we see a reduction in the number of convictions of individuals, then I think the memo will have failed in its purpose. And the memo recognizes that may happen at the very end. It says we may see more corporations going to trial, and we may see fewer convictions in this regard. If that actually happens, then that's unfortunate. Maybe this, therefore, is the only way of trying to, as a last step before going to Congress and asking for more money, show that the Justice Department has exhausted every option that it has before trying to increase the number of people at the FBI or at the SEC. Maybe if this memo does fail in that regard, it will allow people to say we need finally to do that. Unfortunately, I think – It has to be done, and it should be done and faced frontally and done now. We ought not to take the chance that individuals who are clearly guilty are going to be let off the hook simply because the corporation now is going to go to trial or individuals will go to trial. That's the best remedy to deal with this problem. We ought to confront it, and we ought to do it now, rather than try to do it in a backhand way by putting the burden of investigation on corporations.
Thank you, Paul. And before we get to callers, Jim, I want to give you a chance to respond to what Paul said, and I'm also curious. So Paul touched on this, and I read this before, that if a company seeking cooperation credit declines to learn of such facts, it gets no consideration for mitigating factors. What do you think this means in terms of how it's going to play out, and what do you think that that's going to do in terms of affecting, you know, the atmosphere inside the boardroom? And then if you can answer that and respond to anything Paul said, then we'll open it up to questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the key shift that Paul identified up front. I would actually love it to be the case that more of these corporations would actually take the government to trial on these situations rather than just sort of agreeing to do whatever the government says. The problem with that, and why this can be a sort of Scylla and Charybdis type situation for the board to consider here when the Department of Justice comes calling, is that the collateral consequences of going to trial can be huge. I mean, it varies from type of company. Not every company is as sensitive as an accounting firm would be, where the mere indictment basically means they can't certify the books, and it means that their business is over. But for a lot of these companies, there's effectively a death sentence as well, and some of these are due to statutory rules that Congress has enacted. So if you're a drug company and you're going to be excluded from reimbursement under Medicare or Medicaid, you're not, if you're criminally convicted, you really can't roll the dice and risk the whole company at trial. The same is going to be true if you're a financial institution that's going to lose banking or trading licenses. If you're a company that does a lot of contracting with the government, for the Defense Department or what have you, and you're going to be debarred from any government contracting based on a criminal conviction, I mean, all these sorts of things are very, very real out there. The Justice Department knows that they have this heavy stick over the company, and that's why the companies agree to all these agreements time and again. So I think the companies are likely to give a lot stronger consideration, I suppose, to turning evidence over on their own employees. I'm sort of less enthusiastic about that prospect, I suppose, than Paul is, because it worries me in terms of how the corporations actually function. I think there's an inherently a level of trust in a company that's required, and if the company effectively becomes the prosecutor and becomes the agent of the state, I mean, that's what Paul's describing here, is basically we're saying the company is going to become the role of the FBI in investigating its own employees here. That's troubling to me. Now I don't think that's as big a shift from the status quo as what we already have seen. We see that companies identify this through their compliance programs. It's not totally clear what credit they get for self-identifying problems within the company through compliance programs. They tend still to have these agreements, but at least there's a premise that they're getting some credit for doing that, and we see it already. And we see companies having discovered things that I don't think, no matter how much money you allocated to the FBI or SEC or all these sorts of government agencies, I think it'd be very hard without really trampling over civil liberties for them to identify some of the things the companies themselves have discovered. I mean, when you've got a foreign subsidiary of a company in Russia and they discover people getting burner cell phones and texting back and forth in a field and carrying bags of cash, I mean, I to be able to discover those sorts of behaviors, I think, is very unlikely given any reasonable sort of staffing level. So I actually understand why the Department of Justice is doing this, but I worry about its effect on the actual management of doing business. But if at the end of the day what this results in is what Paul seems to be suggesting he's hoping it results in, and that's individual prosecutions, to me the rub isn't whether people are actually going to jail or not, because I think it totally depends on whether they've actually violated the law. The rub here is, though, if they're doing that and they're not exerting so much regulatory authority over businesses, I mean, that's what's really disturbing to me about this whole DPA-NPA shadow regulatory state, is you've got, you know, smart people, but they're English majors with law degrees who are basically assuming vast regulatory authority over huge swaths of the American economy, and that's troubling to me, because there's no check and balance here on this. As Paul noted, the discretion that these Department of Justice prosecutors have is vast. It's enormous. There's no judicial oversight. It's not clear that there's legislative guidance here. It's really the DOJ sees what it wants to see and does what it wants to do.
Yeah, and I assume in terms of the vastness of that power, it's expanded here when you consider things as Paul alluded to respondeat superior, liability, Park doctrine. I mean, if you're essentially in the chain of command and you have some awareness of something that's going on and some underling engages in some kind of misconduct and is in part motivated to do this because in a misguided attempt to thinking that the corporation will benefit, then there are a whole bunch of people who are potentially exposed.
Yeah, any executive could be exposed based on what someone beneath them is doing. If the person's not stealing from the company but violating some federal regulation or law to the corporate benefit, and that's without regard to any sort of compliance program you've got established. I mean, that doesn't mean it would necessarily be easy to get a conviction in all those sorts of cases, but the fact that they could potentially do that makes the situation for corporate executives a lot more tenuous than it already has been.
Sure. Will, why don't we turn it over to you to open it up for questions from the audience.
All right. In a moment, we will all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. Again, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. Looks like we don't have any questions quite yet, John.
Okay, well,
we have one now, so we'll go to that call.
That's fine.
This is Jack Park. Thank you both. Federal employees have the right to warnings before they talk in an investigation. Calkins, Garrity, and unionized employees get Weingarten warnings. Is it fair to corporate employees to tell them that they have to talk and then use what they say against them? Is there the possibility of developing parallel warnings to those that the federal employees get?
Jim, you want to answer that, or you want me to address
it? Well, why don't you take it, Paul? You've actually worked in these DOJ investigations.
Sure. I think it'd probably be one of those circumstances where, over time, employees will wind up learning that they can be at risk, because anything they say to the investigator for the company will wind up being disclosed. I don't think that probably giving them the warning is going to actually help them much in that regard, because in the private sector, they're going to know that they can, in fact, be dismissed for any reason, as long as it's not an improper reason, such as race, religion, and the like, whereas it's not the case in the government. So I think over time, they'll become, you know, widespread sort of public knowledge within the corporation that they are at risk for anything they say. And yet the warning won't really make the interview any more of conducive to getting information, because they know they have a choice. They can say something and it can be used against them, or they can be fired or disciplined in some other way for not talking. It may be that some companies wind up telling this to their employees on their own, but I can't imagine a court requiring it in any way, shape, or form, because even though the government is essentially transferring the regulatory burden to the private party, and even though, therefore, the corporation is assuming the role of federal agents in that regard, they're not going to be deemed, in essence, to be federal agents acting at the immediate behest of, and therefore, I don't think courts are going to say that the investigators or lawyers for the company have to give these sorts of admonitions before they interview the company's employees.
This is John. Let me leap in, because I've actually been part of those conversations where representing an individual when I was in private practice a while ago, and companies will typically give those warnings, even if they're not necessary, because they don't want somebody coming in later and claiming, oh, I thought this was all subject to a joint defense privilege, and litigating those issues or suing the company in some way for having violated their rights. It's a very uncomfortable discussion because the person who's being investigated knows that they can be terminated at any time. They know that any information they provide not only can be turned over but will be turned over. They also know that the attorney whom they now trust is in many cases being paid for by the corporation, and the corporation has the ability, although they're unlikely to do it, but sometimes it will happen, of saying, okay, well, you know, you're not cooperating with us, therefore not only are you fired, but you know, you're still going to be under investigation and we're no longer going to pay for your counsel, which can end up being quite an expensive proposition.
Yeah, and just to add one further comment, and what Paul said is probably correct, in that I don't think a court would likely rule that various warnings might be triggered, but you know, if I were a defense lawyer in these sorts of situations, I think I would certainly make that pitch, and the Yates memo would give me some evidence to do so, right? In the sense that effectively, by making this mandatory versus discretionary in terms of the cooperation credits here, to some degree, you could certainly make a plausible case that the company's deputized. Now, that may be a distinction without a difference, given what John's talked about that normally happens in practice. So, my concern with this, too, again, just sort of redounds to how is this going to affect corporate compliance? Even assuming that you really want companies to double down more on compliance efforts, which may or may not be the right assumption, I want to emphasize, individuals now know that the company is going to turn everything they have over. They may be more hesitant to bring things to the company because there's no escape hatch.
Will, do we have another question?
We do. Let's go to the next questioner.
Great.
Good afternoon, Gerard Lehman, society member in Boston. I joined a bit late. Apologies if you covered this, but I'm wondering if we have seen any material markup in D&O insurance rates in the wake of the Yates memo issuance. I know I've got my own personal legal counsel after that. I'm a pharmaceutical compliance guy, so it's everything you guys mentioned is all quite relevant, and couldn't agree more with the totality of your assessment. I'm just looking for something like macro analytics or some kind of market response to this. Thanks.
I haven't seen it, but that doesn't mean it hasn't happened because I haven't looked. It would seem likely because, as a logical matter, it's a very reasonable way of trying to protect yourself in this regard. People will have lawyers. People will have D&O insurance. And so it doesn't surprise me in the least to hear that you did it, for example. And my guess is a lot of other people will have done it too, but I can't point you to any study that has come out. On the other hand, I haven't looked, so there may be something out there. There may be something in the Wall Street Journal, or there may be an article that a journalist is working on in this regard. I just don't know of any.
Yeah, I don't either, and I think it's probably quite soon for there to be any real evidence of this. I mean, clearly D&O insurance has been a booming industry, and that, you know, it's going all the way back to Sarbanes-Oxley, which dovetails with the Thompson memo and this whole line of inquiry. I mean, the directors and officers are. Yes, if you're advising companies, you better be talking about that.
I'm an Arthur Andersen alumnus, so I'm a bit more paranoid than most, I would say.
Yeah,
but thanks, guys.
Will, is there anyone else in the queue?
We do not have anyone else in the queue. If you'd like to join, please hit star, then the pound key on your phone.
Let me ask a question in the interim, which is that this memo also has a slight expansion, which you guys have touched upon, but only a little bit, which is it not only says, oh, this applies to any criminal prosecution and criminal AUSAs need to pay attention to this, but there needs to be coordination with civil attorneys and any credit for any civil resolution. This is also going to apply to that, given the fact that many of these instances end up with a civil resolution, and the discretion in terms of the amount of fines and whatnot that can be charged in terms of a civil resolution is immense. How do you think that this subtle change is going to play into the calculus that a company is going to undergo when dealing with the government?
I mean, it could be really big, right? The civil side of this, you know, I focused on the criminal side, but the civil side of this dollar-wise is a lot bigger, right? So the DPAs and NPAs, you know, you're talking about the billions annually. You're talking about an order of magnitude larger in civil and, for instance, the banking stuff that's followed with Bank of America and Citi and Chase. I mean, you're talking $17 billion, $13 billion, $7 billion, huge, huge civil awards with really, really sweeping provisions and creation of multi-billion dollar sort of allocation of corporate resources to various sorts of organizations, entities, and things that the DOJ people seem to like. So that could very well be affected by this a lot because, you know, traditionally these have been pretty separate. I mean, unless you guys can tell me if I'm wrong, and that's different from a DOJ insider's perspective. But the fact that you could potentially condition these civil agreements on turning over these potential implicating criminal information on employees is, I think, a pretty profound shift that you're touching on here.
Well, John, let me say I've got four things that came to mind in that regard. The first is, it's difficult to believe that there wasn't this cooperation going on already, and if there wasn't, then shame on the Justice Department. But it's hard to believe that you don't already have the civil and criminal people working together in this regard. So if that wasn't happening, I'd have to be quite surprised. Second thing is, it's going to create a considerable number of Rule 6e challenges. The unless you have the same lawyers doing both the criminal and civil investigation, the government is not going to be able to use the grand jury material, by and large, in the civil case because it may, quote-unquote, disclose matters occurring before the grand jury. Cells prohibited the government from automatically giving over the grand jury material to the civil components. The John Doe case allowed the same lawyers to do it. So unless they have the same lawyers on both, you're going to see potential 6E problems arising here. The third point is that corporations are going to want to wrap up all their criminal and civil liability in one fell swoop. If this result forces more corporations to go to trial, then there could be fewer civil settlements, and ironically, not only will you perhaps get fewer convictions, you may also get fewer dollars coming in. Finally, it's going to create all sorts of new simultaneous prosecution Fifth Amendment issues, because if you're going to wind up doing both of these at the same time, and if you're going to force more cases to go to trial, you're going to have more of these issues being litigated in the district courts, and how district courts handle these is going to be interesting to see, principally because a lot of these are going to be non-appealable issues that neither the government nor a private party can do anything about. So there'll be a lot of district court rulings on these sorts of matters in the near future.
Is it really your thought that that this memo is going to result in more companies going to trial, or just more panic and more coughing up internal investigations and more coughing up with information?
Well, we'll have to see how it plays out. But at the end of the memo, the Deputy Attorney General does note the prospect that there could be more cases going to trial. And if this memo was the result of a working group of criminal and civil people, that must have been one of the discussions that everyone had. And if they note that this is a possibility, to me, I have to take that as meaning it's not purely hypothetical.
I think it certainly could be a possibility, John, although, again, it's going to depend on the collateral consequences that any individual company would face. So it's probably not likely for a lot of types of companies, but for certainly for some, it may be more likely. Certainly it's more likely relative to the status quo ante.
Will, do we have any other callers in the queue?
Our lines are still open. If you'd like to join the question queue, please hit star and the pound key. While we wait to see if anyone has a question, I want to make one quick programming announcement. Our next Teleforum call will be Monday afternoon at 2 p.m. That call is called The Drone Papers, what they reveal about the fight against terrorism and what they don't. Again, if you want to join the question queue, please hit star and the pound key. We've got 10 minutes left. We'd love to take a few more questions, but I don't see any on the line right now, John.
All right. Well, let's give people another couple of minutes. You know, I am curious. So the Thompson memo was was severely criticized because in the wake of it, you had a lot of prosecutors who not only were demanding essentially privilege waivers, but they were also doing things like saying, gee, we took a very, very dim view of joint defense agreements and in fact, take an incredibly dim view of corporations paying the attorney's fees of corporate officers who are in the zone of being targeted for potential criminality. The Philip memo, which was very, very brief, walked that back. This memo really only makes a passing reference to doing things within the bounds of law and privilege. Literally, it says the requirement that companies cooperate completely as to individuals within the bounds of the law and privileges does not mean, and then it goes on to say the department attorney should wait attorneys to do the investigation at the company level, that they should actively pursue this as well. I'm wondering whether you have a sense as to whether this is going to push away from the Philip memo kind of back towards the Thompson memo.
I think it will. This is Paul.
Yeah.
I think it will, because I think what in essence it says is that we're not going to say that we're walking back towards the Thompson memo because we don't want to get back into the fight with the ABA, but that the effect of this is to say, well, now what we'll be doing is making decisions based on the amount and adequacy of the proof you're giving us. And if you're not giving us adequate proof, we don't care what the reason is why you can't. We need you to come forward not only to identify the individuals, but to come forward with all relevant evidence. Granted, okay, we're not saying you have to break a privilege, because if they did that, then that would create all the problems that led to the Philip memo. But if they don't think the proof of guilt is adequate, they can just say they think, sorry, the proof is not adequate, and therefore you're not getting any cooperation credit.
Yeah, this is Jim. I think that's right, what Paul's saying, basically. I mean, it's at least my fear. I mean, they do have that sort of throwaway line. It's not as if they're saying, well, we repeal the Philip memo and that's all out the window. But I do think that it gives that much more discretion to any prosecutor who wants to say that we're not satisfied that you're spending, that the company's working too hard to try to protect its own, right? That's something that they're going to basically be leaning on companies not to do. So it's sort of, as Paul was saying, they're sort of show us the goods if you want to get off. It's sort of things. And by getting off, I use that lightly, because it's not at all clear to me that these DPAs are in the interest of the companies in many of these cases. And in some cases, I think the company would be better served to go to trial. But of course, they're risk averse. And if you're a diversified shareholder that owns stock in a bunch of these different companies, you may say, well, we'll fight back on the government on these more often, because, you know, but if you're actually the manager or the director there, you may be less likely to do that and more willing to cut a deal. So it's not necessarily a negative in my mind if there are more trials here. I'd rather test the rules of law rather than just have the companies collude with the Justice Department on doing what the Justice Department wants to do. If it's actually, you know, the fiduciary duties of the managers and directors here are often at tension with their self-interest, and that's. You know, this may actually make that somewhat less likely, because their self-interest here, they can actually be prosecuted. So they may say, well, we're just going to fight if we're going to be prosecuted anyway.
Yeah, certainly the pervasiveness of the intrusiveness that follows DPAs and NPAs might lead one down that path. I suppose the caller before who used to work at Arthur Andersen might have a different perspective. How are we doing in terms of callers, Will?
Still no questions on the line. We'll make one final call here. Okay. If you want to ask a question before we wrap up, please hit star.
No. Go ahead.
The power key. No? No more questions, John?
No. We can go ahead and see whether we've only got a couple of minutes left. So if somebody wants to call in with a question, that's great. If not, I suppose we can wrap up.
We'll see if someone pops up during closing remarks, but I think we're ready for that.
Okay. Gentlemen, any closing thoughts?
Jim, you want to go first? Go ahead.
Sure, I'll go first. Basically, what we see here is just the continuing refinement of a process. process that was jump-started in 1991 that really began in 93 and began in earnest in 2003 after the collapse of Arthur Andersen with the second memorandum in what's now a series of at least five memos that spell out how the Justice Department deals with corporations. I think the Yates memo is not a huge shift in practice, but it's certainly a shift in emphasis, and it's an emphasis toward going after individuals versus corporations. And it's really a walking back from some of the refinement that's been done since the 2003 Thompson memorandum, pitting corporations against their managers and directors. Where I think it's disturbing to me is that it's not reining in the broad discretionary shadow regulatory state that's emerged over the last decade in the Federal Department of Justice. I think that the economic costs, real costs of that regime are underappreciated. But I do think that individual prosecutions are really what the Justice Department ought to be focusing on rather than trying to regulate corporations more broadly. If individuals are violating federal laws, they should be prosecuted. And so a part of me is cautiously optimistic in that regard, but overall disappointed in where this memo is sending the Justice Department.
Paul? The goal that they're trying to seek here is a noble one. Identify, investigate, charge, and convict the responsible individuals for whatever type of illegal conduct is involved here. It's not the corporation, the inanimate entity that did this. It's the individuals. And we have to find out who they are. We have to investigate so that we can prove the crimes and then charge and convict them. What's concerning is that I think one thing is that it's not clear this is going to be successful in that regard. And the fact that the Deputy Attorney General's memo even gave some caution in this regard, that it might wind up with fewer convictions than before, is troubling, because I can see where that could happen, and that's unfortunate. We should be going after individuals rather than corporations, because they're the ones that do this. Finally, I also think that avoiding an open and honest debate about this issue is unfortunate. The Justice Department should go to the Hill. It should say we need more assets to investigate white-collar cases. I think that should be one of the priorities of any Justice Department, is the investigation of complex white-collar cases. And if they need more assets, ask for them and argue for them. And the president should go to the Hill and make the same case. Doing it in this sort of backhanded way, by shifting the burden of investigation to a corporation, not only is, I think, not necessarily going to work. I think it's the wrong way to run the railroad.
Yeah, it could lead to the law of unintended consequences too. Will, I think that's it. If you don't have any other callers, and perhaps you should wrap up.
Thank you, John. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you and both of our speakers today. Thank you as well to our audience for calling in. We'll hope that you'll join us on Monday at 2 p.m. for our next teleforum call. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.